everybody was in a transition period. I mean, the reform movement, reform and opening, Gaiga Kai Feng, started in 78. So it had been going for 10 years. And the women wore sort of slacks or long skirts with kind of white blouses that kind of came up to the neck. And everybody rode bicycles. Nobody had cars. You'd see someone on a date and it would be like a guy on a bicycle and, you know, and his girlfriend would be sort of kind of straddling a bike, you know, with her legs kind of heading one way. And she's kind of looking at this and, you know, looking at the road in front of them, and they're both kind of moving forward. And like, that was typical. That was what you saw. The only bicycles that were available were, you know, flying pigeon, flying flower. It was always flying something. We were part of something historic, right? We were all seeing something amazing unfold. Like when, you know, Super 8, actually, we managed about a third of the Olympics accommodation village. Wow. So I was really involved. Yeah, that was really a wonderful opportunity to contribute to China and to contribute to something bigger than ourselves. It was great marketing for Super 8, obviously.
Welcome to The Bridge. Fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge. Welcome to The Bridge. Today with us, we have a special guest. We have Mitch Presnick, who is a visiting fellow of practice at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for China Studies, founder of Super 8 Hotels in China, and I've seen those everywhere myself personally, an economy hotel with more than 1,000 locations, and APCO Worldwide China, a public affairs firm. Presnick studied at Peking University here in Beijing and Rutgers Business School and has 35 years experience living in Beijing and Hong Kong. That's the most of any Lawai I've met, I think. Welcome to The Bridge, Mr. Presnick.
Great to be here, Jason. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to see you. I was watching your TED Talk before, you know, I reached out to you, and it was really impressive, by the way. And you mentioned that your uncle encouraged you to come to China originally to pursue your dream of becoming an entrepreneur at a time when foreigners were not really coming to China in large numbers. Could you tell us a little bit about the steps you took to come to China?
Well, I've had a 35-year love affair with China. It started in 1983 when my great uncle Mike, like you mentioned, took me aside at a family event and said, I just came back from China. You know that China is going through a major economic reform and you're an entrepreneur and China's the future and you should get over there as soon as possible. And I thought the idea sounded, you know, interesting, but, you know, what do you do with something like that, right? You're a kid living in the U.S. and all of a sudden you have this uncle who you admire and look up to, you know, telling you to, you know, go halfway around the world and learn a foreign language and go do that. That sounded like a little preposterous to me. But 3 years later, when I saw him at another family event, he came up to me like it was yesterday and he said, so have you thought about, you know, I was like, oh, you mean, oh, that, oh, I didn't even know that there was a difference between Mandarin and Cantonese. I thought, you know, if you're growing up in the US and you're in a Chinese restaurant and you hear a Chinese language, you know, you ask the waiter, what are you speaking? Oh, it's Chinese. You know, you only find out later, right, that it was Cantonese in most cases. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to learn Cantonese. That's an impossible language to learn, I thought at the time. But my Uncle Mike said, listen, just audit a course, you know, see if you can't get your head around it a little bit and you should check it out. I still think it's the future. So I audited a Mandarin class in university and discovered, lo and behold, that actually it's an amazing language and it wasn't nearly as difficult to learn as I thought it would be. It was definitely a lot easier than the Cantonese that I had been listening to since I was a kid watching Bruce Lee movies.
Nine tones.
I mean, you know, it's scary for me. And I lived in Hong Kong for 15 years. I'm still a permanent resident of Hong Kong. Wow. But Cantonese is like next level difficulty from Mandarin. And there's something they're very proud of, that their language is you know, even more complicated. I'm like, as if it needs to be more complicated. But anyway, but that's kind of how I ended up. But the reason why my Uncle Mike was so thrilled about the China opportunity was when he went to China in 83 for his tour, he met the great Sidney Rittenberg. And I don't know if you know who Sidney Rittenberg is, but Sidney Rittenberg was an American who went over to China in like 1942 with the army. And he stayed, he became enamored with the communist movement and went up to Yan'an, you know, with Mao and all of the leadership, and was a contemporary of these guys. And he ended up staying in China for, you know, like 45 years.
Wow.
So Sydney became my mentor. And Sydney was the guy that sort of kind of taught me, well, I guess, most of what I learned in the early years about China. And it was just an incredible opportunity to learn from someone who had been involved in China at that level for so long, but it could also explain China to me in a way that an American could understand, which was rare, right? Because it was all the sort of mysterious, you know, Middle Kingdom stuff. It was much more practical about, you know, things that were explained to me in a way that was relatable, something that, you know, that we could understand. So that's a long-winded answer to your question of how I ended up going there. But Uncle Mike was inspired by Sydney, and then Uncle Mike inspired me, and then it kind of all came around. I ended up being inspired by Sydney as well.
Well, let me ask you a couple, just one question, really. You came to China to study at university at a time when there are very few Americans coming to China. So when you were attending Beijing University, were there other Americans there at all? Were you the only one? Were there a few of you?
You know, there were a number of Americans at Beijing University when I was there. But in those days, you couldn't apply to Beijing University directly. You applied to the State Education Commission, and you could put in a preference. But ultimately, they decided to allocate you to, you know, to wherever they felt you belonged. And I got my first choice. I ended up at Peking University.
Wow.
And when I got there, were a number of Americans. Most of them were with an American university and on like a year exchange program. But there were some university students like me. I was just a grad student. I was, you know, a matriculated grad student in the Duiwai Hanyu Zhongxin, which was underneath the Zhongwenxi, the Chinese Literature Department. And so, you know, there were a number of us, but more than Americans, there were Russians, Germans, there were a lot of Africans. Africa, like people think that this whole China-Africa initiative started more recently, but actually it started even before I arrived in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically there were tons of really impressive four-year African students there that like spoke flawless Chinese. And a lot of them were the sons or daughters of somebody. And so it's amazing, you know, that's a whole separate story, but just the long-term planning that China goes through when it has an initiative. And this was one that came through. But about Americans in China, we were like there at a time that was, you know, there was so much opening and, you know, and there was so much, we called it the Beijing Spring because it felt incredibly open and everybody was excited about the future. And it was, you know, an early opportunity to sort of, you know, see that there is such a natural affinity between Americans and Chinese. You know, it was so easy for Americans to get to know Chinese students. It was so easy for us to sort of get around. Everybody was kind of curious about us. This was not that long after the U.S. and China. It was 9 years after the U.S. and China normalized relations.
Nixon's visit. Kissinger and Nixon, yeah.
Well, Nixon's visit was in 72, but, you know, normalization happened in 79. That was actually under Carter, and this was 88. I arrived on August 8th, 1988, 8888, which is sort of an early premonition about Super 8, but that's another story.
Well, also 4 8s in a row, that's very lucky in like Chinese numerology. So that's certainly like a, you know, powerful message as well.
Fa, 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 fa. Yeah, no, and not only that, but I arrived at 8 p.m. that night on flight UA852, and I was sitting in seat 18A. I mean, I'm just saying it is a little bit interesting that, you know, that I ended up with all these eights. And so I've heard a few Chinese friends that said, you know, you buy you and fend the law. Why? I've heard that expression, you know, a couple of times. But it was a really cool time to be, you know, an American in China. And, you know, of course, now looking at how things have evolved, you know, in some ways, you know, it was a simpler time.
You're listening to The Bridge.
Well, you know, actually, that's my next question. You mentioned Beijing Spring, but, you know, at the same time, 1980s China was not a developed country, not nearly like it is today. So that's, I wanted to ask you, I only arrived in 2012 and modernity had already arrived mostly, but you were certainly before the massive push, the China speed push towards modernity. Could you talk a little bit about how China has transformed since when you first arrived to now?
Yeah. So, gosh. Where do I even begin? So everybody was in a transition period in China in 1988, right? It was, you know, I mean, the reform movement, reform and opening, Gaige Kaifeng, started in 78. So it had been going for 10 years. So you did have people that were, you know, private entrepreneurs. You had people that were starting, you know, to do run private restaurants and whatever, private stores. But the main game in Beijing and most of the major cities was the state-owned world. And so more often than not, people wore, you know, sunfu, you know, the traditional tunics, blue or gray sort of mouse suits, they call them. And the women wore sort of slacks or long skirts with kind of white blouses that kind of came up to the neck. And everybody rode bicycles. Nobody had cars. So, you know, you'd see someone on a date and it would be like a guy on a bicycle and, you know, and his girlfriend would be sort of kind of straddling a bike, you know, with her legs kind of heading one way. And she's kind of looking at this and, you know, looking at the road in front of them and they're both kind of moving forward. And like, that was typical. That was what you saw. The only bicycles that were available were, you know, flying pigeon, flying flower. It was always flying something. And, you know, and there was this huge industry of people that would take care of the bicycles, like, right? Because the bicycles, while they were great bikes, but they needed a lot of tinkering, you know, and it was actually part of the charm. It was like an old British sports car. It was constantly on the verge of breaking down. You know, you had to basically bring your bike at least once a month to, you know, to Lao Wang or Lao Xie or somebody, and they would adjust all the little spokes and they would get the brakes working again because, you know, oh, and then of course the tubes were always, you know, everything was like that. I mean, I'm not trying to paint a picture of just one thing. Everything required a lot of tinkering. Back in 88, you know, but on the other hand, it was like such a magical time. It was like, first of all, you know, there was one fast food restaurant in China at the time, and it was in Beijing. It was like KFC's first flagship right in Tiananmen, and it was a 3-story high KFC. Yeah. And so when we were really feeling decadent, you know, once in a while, because, you know, because it was expensive and you had to use Weihuizhen, the foreign exchange currency. Oh, that's another thing. We couldn't use renminbi. I mean, we did.
Yeah, I've heard about this from someone else once, and I was very surprised because it wasn't the case when I arrived. So you guys had your own separate foreigner currency. Wow.
Oh, right. I mean, China is very good at this, right? China, when they want to try something new, like, you know, currency exchange, they're not just going to open up the whole market. They're going to basically ring fence it and protect the main market from that. And they'll do a little experiment. That's the concept of the special economic zones, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing. So FEC, foreign exchange currency, was what foreigners could receive if you went to a bank or to one of the hotels.
Do you have any of that? Because I'm imagine that's going to be a collector's item par excellence.
You know, the thing was, none of us held on to our FEC because there was a black market for FEC. Because the FEC could then be exchanged for renminbi because there were a lot of products in China that you had to have FEC to buy. And there were even stores that you had to have FEC to use, to spend. So like, for example, the Friendship stores and the Friendship Hotel near Haidian, kind of, well, it's near, I guess, Haidian Lu, which is, yeah, Haidian is near the...
They still have the Friendship bookstore there. I go there sometimes.
In those days, it was the only game in town. Like if you wanted bread or you wanted cheese or if you wanted, you know, to buy a television from Japan, then you had to go to the Friendship store and use foreign exchange currency. So there were a lot of Chinese people who were willing to pay a premium for FEC. And so we would go to the black markets and we would trade FEC for renminbi because you could basically, you know, get between 1.5 and 2 times the money for it. And we were poor students. Like I was living on $100 a month. You know, so $100 a month. I mean, if you can turn that into $150, that's a 50% increase in how much you can spend. Now, things were inexpensive then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you ever wanted to do anything like go get a coffee at the Shangri-La coffee shop or whatever, you needed to spend real money for that kind of stuff. And I didn't have a lot of that. So we would all go to the black market and we would trade. So as a result, I didn't keep a lot of my FEC, unfortunately, but I do have a little bit.
I have an incredible portrait of the time in my head now. Could you talk up maybe a little bit about how that changed, what it was like watching the transformation of that China to, you know, 2008 Olympics China?
That's a big jump. So, you know, I've always thought that like China progress is kind of like those stop frame photography where you watch like a plant go from a seed into like this huge cannon, you know, in 5 seconds. I mean, you know, but if you're talking about going from 88 to 2008, like the change is very hard to describe without at least first talking for a minute about 1998, mm-hmm. because from 88 to 98, that's when things went from, we started in 88 kind of closer to the Cultural Revolution end than we did to the Olympics, right? So you know, you have to remember mindset and fashion and food and even like economics were very much still rooted in, you know, China's past. By 98, they were like barreling forward into the future. And so I can imagine the transition from 98 to 2008 a lot more easily than I can from 1980 to 1998. So that I think is to set the table, you know, first of all. But by the time we got to 2008, I mean, the biggest change was there was a feeling in 88 where it was just kind of like this amazing love affair happening between China and all of the foreigners that were there. And people loved to visit. Everybody wanted to come to China to visit because it was like stepping into another world. By the time we got to 2008, it was still like another world, but it was more familiar, right? Mm-hmm. You had all of the car brands were there. All of the hotel brands were there. All of the restaurant brands. I mean, try to imagine coming to a place that has nothing familiar other than a few pockets, like, you know, like I mentioned, the friendship stores and the friendship hotels, but everything else was something different. You know, the beer didn't come in little bottles. It came in 640 milliliter bottles. And, you know, the, and, oh, and by the way, the, you know, they were preserved with formaldehyde in the early years. So all of that was happening. By the time you got to 2008, there were tons of things that were familiar. And there was another big change, which was that China at that point was already hitting like very much a new gear. It was already figuring out that it was, it could have a much more muscular economic policy. It was now, you know, dominating or starting to dominate major industries in 88 and even in far as 98, you know, you really felt rather special being, I'd say, you know, a foreigner in China. It was, I mean, it still does feel it's very special to me. That'll never go away. But in terms of sort of being, you know, in a very unique position to offer something because of just by virtue of the fact that you come from a country somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That was starting to end by 2008, at least in my mind. But it was replaced by this other feeling that there was this great deal of pride that you started to realize there was the recognition that we were part of something historic, right? We were all seeing something amazing unfold. Like when, you know, Super 8, actually, we managed about a third of the Olympics accommodation village. Wow. So I was really involved. Yeah, that was really a wonderful opportunity to contribute to China and to contribute to something bigger than ourselves. It was great marketing for Super 8, obviously, you know, because we argued that Super 8 was the perfect company to help with that because we could bring international standards, but the Olympic Accommodation Village wasn't five-star. It was more sort of mid-scale economy, exactly positioned like Super 8. Mm-hmm. So that was a great opportunity for us to be involved in something bigger than ourselves. And it gave me an opportunity to spend a lot of time around the Olympics. Mm. And we were sitting there in the closing ceremonies and just kind of like the bum, 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 we're here. You know, we were all like, holy smokes. Like you, that was really, for me, that was the big shift. Like going from watching China kind of find its way back into the international community to all of a sudden saying, you know, you, there's one thing you didn't know about us. We're a perennial like champion in this community that you are just now seeing us re-enter, but we've been here. Like you could really get a sense that, okay, like this is much more than just a country and a growth story. This is the resumption of a 2,500 year trend of excellence and leadership. And in many ways, like a kind of strength that not many countries can put together, right? I mean, you can really feel it when you were there at that time. And that, so I remember, so 2008 in particular was an important time because I consider that to be sort of the transition. That was like, there was people that had been in China pre-2008, and then there was people that had been in China post-2008. And
yeah, that's
a very different.
I think even us foreigners who did come later, we see the same thing because the international attention that China got in 2008 was so over the top that it really did kind of mark historic, a pivotal kind of shift. But I want to switch gears. Now, in America, we are taught to be that if we want to make it, right, you really want the American dream, you need to be an entrepreneur. And yet most people, they don't want that. It's too difficult for them. They're too reticent to throw themselves out there and put everything at risk. And so a lot of people never make that jump. Even people who say, if I could be an entrepreneur, I would do this. But you did become an entrepreneur. But you didn't just become an entrepreneur. You became an entrepreneur on the other side of the planet in a developing nation. So could you walk us through becoming the founder of Super 8 Hotel China and, you know, describe some of the challenges maybe that you had that entrepreneurs back home may not have encountered?
You know, there's a reason why there are so few entrepreneurs from the West that have done what I did. It's not a route that most people can get their heads around because you're definitely competing against the home court advantage, right? And even someone like me who invested my entire life and career and, you know, and everything into, you know, China, and even someone like me who always looked, what can I contribute? What can I offer? Always, that was always the approach. Never, what can I get? You know, those were table stakes. That was just so you don't get like thrown out on your ass, you know. But I wrote a business plan while I was still an undergrad taking a business management major at James Madison University. My plan was I was going to go to China, spend 2 years learning Chinese, not the written language. I thought I could just get by with the spoken language because I figured there'd be lawyers and accountants to do all that kind of stuff. That lasted me about 3 days at Peking University before they basically said, I think you need to understand you're Peking University and you're trying to basically propose that we put you in remedial Chinese, you know, at one of the best schools in China. So the plan that I had was I was going to come from the future. The U.S., of course, you know, is very, very good at brand building, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, here's a country that's coming out of, you know, 35 years of command communism. There's no concept of intellectual property. There's no concept of brands. China had like three brands at the time that people would have heard of, including Air China. But the main brand was Qingdao Beer, which was originally a German brewery built in the city of Qingdao that the Chinese took over. So I knew that if I could come from, you know, the U.S. with brand experience, it would be like coming from the future. And it seemed like a lot easier than having to figure out something on my own. I figured I'll just, you know, represent the best of U.S. branding. And I always liked U.S. companies. And I still am a huge fan of American multinationals. If you follow me on Twitter, as you do, you'll see I'm constantly singing the praises of multinationals. I'm convinced that that is the best thing that the U.S. has ever produced. Is the modern multinational corporation US style, because, you know, they've been able to compete and thrive and win in countries all over the world, including China.
I mean, there's a common joke that you could go anywhere in the world in 1980s and find a Coca-Cola, right? So yeah.
You could find a Coca-Cola in China in 1980s too, but it just wouldn't be cold. You know, in fact, they had a whole campaign that Coca-Cola produced, which was to encourage people to ice the Coca-Cola before they drink it. And it was Bingle Yiho Gongshi Coco, right? How does that translate? After it's cold, it's even more delicious. The truth is, Coke is not delicious if it's not cold. So they had to basically teach the country to do it. And the funny thing was, and this is a great example of just how one can think they know something and then they show up and realize that they're totally wrong. But when I first arrived there, I thought, oh, they don't understand that beer should be cold and that Coca-Cola should be cold. And then I found out through Chinese medicine that actually, no, there's a lot of wisdom to the idea of drinking room temperature or warmer liquids because it's less detrimental to the system. And, you know, but at the time I thought, oh, you know, we're going to be teaching them all these things. And I guess that's a recurring theme in my life is, you know, I went over there thinking that I was going to be teaching something. And in the end, I ended up just, you know, being humbled by it all. And, you know, you learn over time, okay, you know, better to be in a state of humility and receiving information when you're in China, right? Because the minute you think you know something in China, that's usually when you're running into trouble. But anyway, I wrote this plan about how I was going to bring an American brand to China. And I thought that it would take 5 years to do all of that. And then maybe another year or two to like blow up the company, make it really big, and then exit and leave. So I did actually accomplish my business plan, but it took 20 years longer than I thought.
Wow.
You know, and many more near-death experiences in the process.
Wow. Let's do near-death experience. You know, I think it's really interesting that you found this here in China specifically. And I was wondering, you know, what kind, okay, because my goal in this show is to try to get more Americans to come over here, whether it's to start a business or just get a job or maybe study, just so we can have more people-to-people exchanges at all levels. So I want to know what kind of things that, you know, it's obviously different 20 years ago. What sort of challenges did you encounter that people might want to be aware of? Or what kind of challenges do you think there exist now for people who might want to be start a business? Because I think a lot of our listeners do want to know that. A lot of our people who approach me on Twitter ask me, hey, I want to start a business in China. And my answer is, I have no idea how to do that. So maybe you could fill in some of that empty space.
Look, I think there's the legal environment and then there's just the operating environment. They're very different conversations in that regard. Generally, I would say, you know, for what I did, I'm not sure it would be even possible now to like sort of bootstrap a national business and build it up. But, you know, if you were to do it, you would have to have something really unique that the Chinese market needed but didn't have. And in this case, what I brought was a concept of economy hotel chains from the US, and I brought the concept of franchising. So these were concepts that, you know, had been tried a little bit before, but not really successfully. And I believe there weren't really many, and I still believe there aren't really many things that you can say are an advantage when you're a foreign operator in China. But the few that you have are, you know, foreign companies are very systems and process oriented. You know, in the 80s and 90s, China was very people oriented, right? You know, Mao Zedong's famous quote is, you know, Ren shi zhuiding the yinsu, right? People are the deciding factor. And I think generally most businesses that succeeded, they ended up basically adopting that mentality, whether they were foreign, the Chinese companies were already that way. But then if you were a foreign business, you had to bring that system orientation. Like, you know, for example, in the economy hotel space, everybody was really good at building out hotels, but not necessarily really good about instituting, you know, regular maintenance plans. So they thought about it differently. They're like, well, let's just build this thing out and we'll make all our money back in 2 or 3 years. And then we'll run it into the ground in another 3. And then we'll just renovate the whole thing completely. Whereas we were like, no, no, no. There's like daily maintenance, weekly maintenance, monthly maintenance, yearly maintenance. And then, you know, and so we were able to bring a mindset which was, you know, for the few things that we thought we had an advantage, we definitely wanted to engage those advantages as much as we possibly could. I'm not sure that those advantages exist anymore, right? I think like China's basically like holistically organized now. I mean, yes, they still have, like any country, they have their strengths and weaknesses sort of, you know, in terms of business. But just the very fact that, it's such a hyper-competitive market, China, it's generally a place where I recommend foreign businesses go to cut their teeth competing against these incredibly capable companies in a gladiator's arena. And then, then you go back and it's like putting a piranha in the koi pond when you go back to your own country, you know. Like, and the other thing has to be said, you know, it has to be said that when you're looking at competing globally now, especially for an American company, you know, you need to basically look at how you compete against Chinese companies and in China and in the US and internationally, because that's the game. Like, everybody's talking about the competition between the US and China. The real competition between the US and China internationally is a commercial conversation. It's, you're talking about the largest GDP in the world, and then the largest GDP by a purchasing power parity calculation. These are the two countries competing on every sphere. But the one thing we know for sure is that Chinese multinationals are incredibly competitive now because they compete in that really tough environment in China. And then they come out and, you know, when you see a company like BYD, you know, all of a sudden just overtake everybody out of nowhere, or you see like a Temu come into the US and take a 20% share of the discount retail market in the US in like, you know, in like a year and a half. That's how it happens. It's, they were, you know, operating below the line and working out and getting themselves fit. And so when you look to compete, you want to compete in the China market first and just learn as much as you can there against your Chinese competitors and then maybe go abroad. I think that's the real competition now, is it's the commercial competition. That's the one that I focus on. I mean, I'm I have very little interest in politics or or strategic. I mean, there's a million people that are in that space. For me, I'm particularly interested in the U.S.-China commercial relationship and the competition between the two, because like you were saying, it's primarily people to people, right? And actually, the stability in the U.S.-China relationship is much reliant on shared interests as it is, you know, mutual defense or whatever.
I completely agree with you. Our business links are so incredibly deep.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to The Bridge.
I want to ask another question, but I'm going to come back around to how Sino-U.S. relations and economics a bit. But one of the things that many books have been written about is the cultural connection for management. So as you know, even 20 years ago, when you were managing Super 8, how were cultural differences factored into how you managed your company?
Well, for one thing, English was not allowed in the office.
Wow.
Like I thought, you know, our customers are Chinese, our franchise partners are Chinese, our regulators are Chinese. I mean, everybody, our employees are Chinese for the most part. We had a couple of foreigners. I did not like hiring foreigners for the most part. Like, I was looking always for how I could make myself obsolete because I knew that, you know, I mean, first of all, I'm a 0-1 entrepreneur. You have to know your alleys, right? If you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're either a 0-1 or a 1-N entrepreneur. 1-N entrepreneurs are more like the kind of folks that can run any business. But a 0-1 entrepreneur is someone that usually is using inspiration and, you know, and vision and energy and, you know, and relationships in some kind of format. So we needed to create a Super 8 that, like in our world, we were hoping that people didn't even realize it was an American brand. But the ones that did would know that it's the largest economy hotel chain in the U.S. And then at the time, in the world. Now the Chinese brands, of course, are much bigger than Super 8, both in China and globally. But at the time, we were the largest. And I remembered from my days when I was part of the team that brought Budweiser to China, that there was some cachet to being like, you know, the best-selling champagne brand in France or the best-selling American beer in the US or whatever. Because then they were like, okay, well, that home country that this comes from has validated them by making them the largest. So that's interesting. So we used as much of we could of foreign branding that we had. But when it came to execution, we tried to make it as local as possible. I would say that we were really tight on our quality standards. And to this day, Super 8 still has the highest quality ratings of any economy hotel chain in China.
I see them around all the time in Beijing.
Yeah, you know, I hope you get a chance to stay in some there. I mean, I'm very proud of what we did because, well, the thing I'm most proud of with Super 8 is I didn't get a chance to make a dollar on that thing until after all the franchisees got rich. So we made hundreds of Chinese millionaires, like, you know, who were able to, through their own hard work, and then, of course, a little bit of support from us, the platform we provided and the systems, we were able to basically create a ton of successful Chinese entrepreneurs who the first time they would be like, they would somehow get a hold of an economy hotel that, or it was more likely not an economy hotel, like just some building, like 4,000 square meter building, you know, you're typical, you see them all over China, you know, it's a basic size, they're used in many ways. And then they would strip them down to the concrete and then build them out as a hotel. And the first time I would meet these new franchisees, you know, they pick me up in a Shalicha or whatever like car they were coming. By the third time I was visiting them, they'd be driving a Bentley. and I'm still driving like a little Audi, but it was okay. Like it was cool. Like I knew it was like, you know, they looked at win-win as, you know, I get to win twice. And that was kind of how I had to approach it. You know, I was always cool with that, right? Like I was always very cool with that idea because, you know, Dao Shima Shen, Chang Shima Ge, like wherever you go, you sing the local song. And I was always good with that. But, you know, a lot of foreigners couldn't get their head around that. They were always looking for, you know, at any given moment, I want there to be parody. Well, there was never going to be parody. Like you're a foreigner in China, man. You're like, you know, you're not going to get parody. You'll get goodwill. And if you're cool with being, you know, flexible about things, you know, you'll end up doing well. I think that's how it worked out, you know, for me and for Super 8 and for the brands that have done well that came from outside of China.
Well, part of what you do is international relations, economic wise. And I've noticed over the last few years when, you know, Sino-U.S. relations, you know, politically, which you say you don't want to talk about, that's fine, have been kind of low. The whole time, our businesses have been growing in China. So McDonald's, Disney, even with this two theme parks, two Disney theme parks. I want Americans to keep that in mind. Tesla, Apple, Tim Cook comes over, Elon Musk comes over. Elon Musk is actually enhancing the size of his businesses in China all the time. Starbucks is adding 2,000 new stores over the next couple of years. Hilton is growing more. So American businesses in China are growing. Now, KFC is a bit different because Yum Brands is incorporated in Shanghai, but there are 10,000 KFC. It was 40,000. I can't even remember. You know, American businesses are booming in China. And as you pointed out earlier, tons of Chinese businesses are starting to move into the US. I even noticed that there's a Chinese factory joint venture opening a factory in Columbus, Ohio to produce solar panels. So in terms of, like, we were talking about people-to-people exchanges, Sino-US relations, is it your opinion that business, international franchise, are the bulwark of our diplomacy? What do you think?
I think that the commercial relationship between the US and China has always been the ballast and the reason for both sides to work together, shared interests, right? You know, win-win and all that stuff. You know, it was a great marriage in the early years because the US had tons of business know-how and Six Sigma and, you know, just all of the wonderful things that American multinationals could teach at the time. And you had like this amazing market with, you know, reasonable labor costs and hardworking, you know, smart population and a desire to get ahead. Plus, and this was part of my original thesis for going to China, you know, one thing that I knew before I ever went to China was that a lot of the Chinese people I knew, they kind of seemed to equate financial success with a lot of other things that were valuable, like good family and education and just, you know, happiness and things like that. You know, they have a god of money, Cai Shen, you know, and yeah. So I thought, okay.
I've got one at home.
Here are folks that, like, once they're given the opportunity to make money, like, this whole country is going to just explode upwards. Like, that was kind of, you know, everybody else at the time thought I should go to Japan. And I was like, Japanese, I don't know that the Japanese are that into money. I want to go to a place where the people are really into money and haven't been allowed to make money. So for me, it was no brainer that China would become a successful country. But more important, I just knew that the business relationship was like a hand in glove thing. Because for one thing, any American that spends time in China knows this, and you know this really well, is that Chinese and Americans just get along really well together. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, we both have this belief in the greatness of our countries. We both come from great countries that have made a massive impact in the world. The US obviously has a very short history and China has a very long one. But nonetheless, you know, anyone who's American has to be proud of what America has created in its short time here. And, you know, the technology we've created, we put men on the moon. You know, there's just like a million things that you can look to and say that's something. And the Chinese have the exact same feeling. So while our systems may be, you know, like the equivalent of different religions that almost make us, as, you know, present, as Professor Huang Yasheng says here at MIT, he says, you know, we were two people that got married before we understood each other's religions. But on a people-to-people level, it was like a massive love affair between us. And it still is, like, you know, Chinese and Americans just really get along. Whereas if you were to say, I'm not trying to single them out, but say Russia, you know, Russia and China had very compatible systems, at least ostensibly compatible. And yet they didn't get along at all for many, many years because, you know, they don't have that natural affinity the way Americans do. So, I mean, that's a huge advantage when you have people getting along with people. The rest, one would think you'd be able to figure out, but definitely in business, we're very compatible. Mm. And that's something that I think is probably the greatest stabilizing force that we have. And it's a good thing too, because, you know, there's a lot of things on the other side of that ledger, you know, to worry about, not to mention the security issues and political differences and all the other things. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
You know, Yellen keeps coming back to China. She was here last year. Gavin Newsom was here. Blinken was here. Blinken and Wang Yi just met again. And they've met like a couple of times in the last year. Thank goodness. You know, it looks like our relationship is improving. There's a lot of talk a couple of years ago about decoupling. Eventually it became de-risking. And now it's just kind of gone. Like, so do you think that our business relationships have moved our diplomacy forward in a way that is meaningful? Because it doesn't seem to me that we can do without one another, logistically even.
Well, the reality is this isn't 1962, right? I mean, we live in a hyper-connected world. The idea of decoupling is, forget about the infeasibility of it. I mean, does that seem like something that should really be occurring alongside the fourth industrial revolution, exponential technology, AI? You know, I mean, it's kind of like that old Sesame Street song, which one of these doesn't belong? I mean, honestly, the idea that the U.S. and China can't figure out a way to peacefully coexist and even find areas of mutual cooperation, it's just so primitive. It's just so backwards ass that, like, you know, it's hard to imagine that otherwise really intelligent people would think that way unless they're in a zero sum scarcity mindset, tribal mindset. Like, I mean, it doesn't make sense from any other point of view. And what are the one thing we know about everyone in that mindset? That's where humanity came from. That's not where humanity's going. Like, you know, you're not here, these kinds of, like, either the human race will extinguish itself in the next 100 years, or we're going to evolve past that kind of thinking. And I think that it helps a lot to look at the U.S.-China relationship in the context, right? You know, that's what Sidney Rittenberg would always say, you know, the only thing that matters in life is truth and context, and one without the other is useless. So, I mean, you know, the truth is there are a lot of major disagreements between the U.S. and China and different attitudes and lots of reasons for people to be very concerned. But on the other side of it, you know, there's also a greater need for us to sort of evolve. And the U.S.-China relationship is kind of a canary in the coal mine for how well Homo sapien can deal with the issues of the future, because our technology now just doesn't allow us to operate the way we did in the past, right? We can't just pollute as much as we like because our technology is too powerful now. We can actually destroy the Earth with, you know, a selfish, disconnected mindset about how we behave on Mother Earth. And we can't survive if we try to act like tribes carrying sticks when we live in an age where we can blow each other up a million times over. So this is really the work that we're doing, people like you and people like me and many others. It's very important for the future of the world because it's kind of setting out either we're going to be bringing thought leadership to the future or not. And I love the idea that we're on the right side of technology and our place, you know, in human history. I mean, that's where folks like you and I can make a difference. There's nothing for us to do if it's you're right, I'm wrong, or I'm right, you're wrong. I mean, honestly, I mean, the only way you can really look at the U.S.-China relationship is a symbiotic relationship. And the one thing to forget about symbiotic relationships is they don't have to be voluntary. They're symbiotic, whether they're voluntary or not. In fact, this is a case where I would say the U.S. and China, it can't de-risk that much or decouple that much without creating a lot of problems for themselves. And, you know, the U.S. controls global payments and the reserve currency. China is dominant in global manufacturing and trade. So what ends up happening is if either country tries to decouple or disconnect from the other, they basically banish themselves into an isolated position because the majority of the world isn't going to be standing on the side of either the U.S. or China 100% of the time. They're going to be in the middle sort of as the referee going, all right, like, you know, we agree with you on this, but we don't agree with you on that. Right. And Europe, by the way, is very much in that position now where, like, you know, they're going to stay kind of neutral where they can. They're not going to take sides because it doesn't make sense for them to, because they see what everyone sees, which is, no, you want to do that, you go do that. But then we can't really play with you there. Like, we're going to basically stay over here in the middle. We're going to keep our options open. And then the global south, which, you know, China is in a much better position now than the U.S. to sort of, you know, have reach into that world and to offer them an alternative to, you know, what has been a system which is kind of, you know, let's be honest, it hasn't been exactly a level playing field unless you're in the Club of 30. It's a way for the best thing that can happen is the U.S. and China realize that their selfish interests demand that they find a way to get along with, you know, the other party, because it's not in their own interest not to. That's what they're going to come to. And they're going to come to it kicking and screaming when they've basically exhausted all of the other possibilities, but they'll get there.
Well, since you pointed out the marriage analogy, I've been thinking about everything you've said in that context, and it actually works perfectly on so many levels. But I do want to, you know, kicking and screaming the whole thing. I want to ask one more question, because obviously you know China's economy better than most Americans. I mean, 99.999% of Americans. So a lot of people, big magazines, newspapers have been saying for the last year or so that China's economy is slowing and all kinds of other things. So I think it might help if you could give some context and tell, could you explain how is China's economy actually doing? Is there room for growth? What are prospects like in the near and midterm?
So I've always felt that when you look at a country like the US or China, it's like a Rorschach test. It says more about you, the viewer, than the thing you're viewing, right? Because you can look at the US and see whatever you want. I mean, I look at the US and I can see that the middle class is under assault, that neither party seems to really be doing anything to really protect the middle class. And the middle class was the goose that lays the golden eggs in the United States, and it's responsible for
growth.
The U.S. Yeah. Where it is. Yes. I mean, that and an innovation culture and excellence and rule of law, those things made the U.S. a powerful, respected country. But I could also look at the U.S. and I could see, all right, I don't really like some of what we do internationally. And, so I can look at these things and I can stay fairly objective. When I look at China, I do the same thing. So I'm one of these weird birds that I actually somehow can see the whole thing. And I don't really judge them. I stay very much a bridge in the middle. I know your podcast is called The Bridge, so you can certainly relate to this. So when I look at the Chinese economy, I look at it and I see, number one, I see an economy that's not going anywhere but up. It's not going to fall off a cliff. They have an entirely new infrastructure. They don't have a crazy amount of national debt. They do have a pretty crazy amount of municipal and local debt that's on the balance sheet, indirectly on the national ledger. So they've got a real issue that they've got to deal with. Incidentally, the US and China both have aggregate debt of about 350% of GDP. I'm just saying it's very coincidental. If you add mortgage debt, consumer debt, national and local debt, if you add it all up, it's 350% in both cases. But China's debt is not any more fatal than the US's debt. It's serious. Like, I mean, the U.S. is technically insolvent right now, right? Our individual tax revenues actually just about equal our debt payments at this point. So, I mean, that's pretty scary. And yet, I don't think it's going to bring down the ship because it's a massive economy with massive benefits. So when I look at the U.S., I see that Rorschach test and I kind of go, okay, it's a mixed bag. When I look at China and the Chinese economy, I see the same thing. Because on the one hand, they've got more STEM grads than the US by a multiple, and they've got momentum moving in the right direction, and they have productivity efficiencies, which are diminishing, but still fairly impressive. On the other side of the ledger, they have a real issue with consumer confidence, investor confidence, and entrepreneur confidence, right? And if I were to look at the economic performance of, say, like my Super 8 hotels or the Budweiser business in China, it's a very good story. It's a very positive look. But if I look at other industries, they're clearly trying to retool some aspects of their economy, which they had to. Look, they were relying for too long on an export investment led manufacturing, property development, and infrastructure-based economy. It was basically kind of like free money. Whenever they started to have economic troubles, they would just basically gin up the investment. And they needed a lot of investment. So you needed to build infrastructure, and you needed to build telecom infrastructure. If you want to create productivity in an economy, you need to have all those things. So even like when you hear people talk about ghost cities or, massive disconnects in the property market, some of that is true, but that was also because they're trying to basically urbanize a rural country. You had, essentially 90% of the population or 85% of the population lived in the countryside when I arrived. And now we know the story now. It's the majority of people live in cities. How is that going to happen unless you build an enormous amount of property? So that whole demand curve shifted when they basically created the supply they needed to on infrastructure and on property. And of course, you were going to have some disconnects, and that was inevitable. And in China, some of those disconnects are even greater. I mean, look, oversupply of an industry is exactly what happens in every industry in China. Like, I was involved in the early 90s in the leather industry in China because I was helping this American guy who had a pretty sizable leather manufacturing business in Hong Kong. And then they started manufacturing in China. And I remember going up to Panyu, which is like in the Guangdong. It's not too far from Shenzhen and Dongguan. And it was all like dirt roads, and there was like one leather clothing and goods factory. And then I went back like 4 months later and there were like 9 factories. Went back like another 6 months later and there were like 35 factories. And I was like, holy smokes. And they actually started to like take global share. Like they were actually getting they were getting it from all the countries that had been doing it, like Mexico and Thailand and whoever. They just basically just sucked it all up because they created a vertically integrated logistics system, which made it just really attractive for people to go there. But what else happened was they ended up knocking out a lot of competitors outside of China. And then they basically started to cannibalize their own industry because, you know, the world did not need 40 Chinese leather factories. They needed like 10. So like there was a consolidation that happened after they had already knocked out all the competition. But it wasn't like a planned effort. It was just something that happened. It was something that they do as part of their normal process of getting a handle on an industry, is that lots of entrepreneurs pile in and say, well, I'm here pretty early and I have just as good a shot as everyone else. And I got this money coming in and I'm going to figure it out. And most of them actually don't succeed. But the ones that do succeed are battle hardened. So the entire economy is that rolled up, right? When people think about the Chinese economy, you have to remember it's really just millions and millions of entrepreneurs on the one side who have become larger businesses in some cases. And some of them become massive businesses like Jack at Alibaba or Pony or any of these are the really successful entrepreneurs. But on the other side, you've got these state-owned businesses, which are a completely different animal, far more impressive than I expected. Like people think of state-owned companies in China, that's the other part of the economic story, right?
I find that fascinating for a kind of a different reason. Like, you know, we have boom bust in the US and you don't really have that as much in China. What I've noticed is that if there is an economic downturn to some extent in China, one of the things that seems to manage it is that tens of millions of people work for SOEs and no one's getting fired. So like, even if there is a downturn, there's stability in employment that just isn't going anywhere. We are out of time. Where can people find you on Twitter? What is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at Mitch Presnick, MitchPresnick. Yeah. And I do spend time on Twitter and, everyone is welcome on my.
Thank you so much for your time. Maybe we can have you back in the future as well.
Great to be here, Jason. Thank you so much for everything you do and wish you well.
Thank you.